Look at those epaulets.
Right?
Gentlemen.
Holy mackerel. We got to slide those things down a little bit.
They're too new. Run them over with the car.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Don't judge me. Okay?
Did you turn them like backwards so that we all know that you fly a big regional jet? Wasn't that a thing back in the day?
No. What?
You didn't hear about this? Back when the CRJ 900 came out, there was some guys, I think it was at what used to be Pinnacle, I think it was. Huh. And then they would like turn them so that the fat side was up.
Yeah.
Just so, because that was, they're a 9 pilot, like a DC 9.
Oh,
no,
my.
The 9, the CRJ.
The 900. Jesus. God.
The views, comments, stories, and opinions shared within this podcast are our own, or those of our guests, and in no way represent the views of the companies, associations, or organizations that any of us may work for or represent. All stories, events, and tales shared within this episode may or may not have happened in the manner in which they were told. They may or may not have even happened at all. The details have been changed to protect the innocent and the guilty alike. This is Squawk Ident. You are listening to Squawk Ident, an aviation podcast that explores the many pathways to an aviation profession, the challenges that a professional aviator can expect in today's marketplace, and we share many stories along the way. I'm your host, Aviator Tony, a professional airline pilot currently flying for a U.S. legacy airline with close to 20 years on the flight line. Welcome aboard Flight 114 of the Squawk Ident podcast, recorded on the 20th of July, 2022. From the Aviator Sound Studios from somewhere in Southern California. On today's flight, Captain Roger and Rob D. join me as we discuss some of the advantages and disadvantages of corporate flying versus airline flying. Alex D. also drops by to fill us in on his progression during his initial operating experience sequence. Captain Roger fills us in on what it is like to fly Mach 0.9 at 47,000 feet in the G650. And we discuss some of the differences between flight deck philosophies between Boeing and Airbus designs. Finally, we explore a little history of the second busiest airport in the country. Any guesses? Stick around to find out. So stay with us as we run our final checks and prepare to push off the gate. Flight 114 of the Squawk Ident podcast is officially underway. Joining us today is an exceptional aviator and Squawk Ident co-host. He is a professional CFI, II, and MEI flight instructor, a former Embraer 145 airline pilot, a King Air instructor, a Dassault Falcon 900EZ and 2000 pilot, and a G650 commander as well. He is a captain, a director of flight operations, and corporate operator. He joins us fresh from 3 weeks of continuous flying in the Falcon 2900 and the Gulfstream 650. Filling out his logbook has been a real blast. From his studio, from somewhere in San Diego, California, please help me in welcoming back to the show, Captain Roger. Captain, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Tony, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
It's good to see you again. It's been a little while for me.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Yeah.
It's been interesting. I'll just say that.
Yeah, I know we've been going back and forth with text messages and whatnot, trying to get you on the show to update us on all of your flying and everything. And I got excited when Jetpack Man was one of the stories from last week, or last episode, I should say.
I thought of you. I saw that. That one had to been, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago? I saw that come across the news, and I just had to laugh myself because I immediately thought of you guys.
Yeah, you know, we've had a blast with Jetpack Man, and you know, who knows the validity of it all. I still think that it's a balloon or something, a drone or something that someone rigged, because how do you get away with taking off and landing in a full jetpack suit? No one has captured it and put it on Twitter or TikTok or who knows what other social media. So the last time you were on the show, Roger, was May 3rd.
I wish I could say that was surprising. It doesn't seem like that long ago, but then when I was just kind of sitting here thinking about it, it had been a while.
Yeah, I mean,
I've been pretty busy.
Yeah, well, that's no joke. I mean, your title and your what you do for your corporate operations is amazing. I don't know how you do it. Your phone is ringing 24/7. You have so many hats that you're filling. The reality of corporate flying is that there's just so much more going on the other side of the cockpit door, not on the flying side, but the back side of the cockpit door, that
Yeah.
Most people don't get it.
It's definitely different. And it varies by operator a lot. I mean, you know, we've gotten to the point now where we have, you know, we have four airplanes that we operate, but we still do it on a smaller level. A lot of corporate operations, I mean, you have positions, you have jobs, a person does this specific job. They do scheduling, they do logistics, they do, you know, planning for the crews. That, you know, they have, when you get into a bigger operation, they have more people to support that operation. And for us, it's still just the pilots, really. And so that's where for me specifically, and where I'm at, that's kind of where the multiple hats comes from, because all this stuff still needs to get done. And yes, you are right. There is a lot of it. And it's all the same stuff that you guys deal with at an airline, except you guys have departments whole departments that do a lot of this stuff. And for us, it's just us, because we don't have that extra layer of support, if you will. And it's definitely become quite the operation, I guess. Flying too. And which kind of reminds me, I guess I should educate you at some point. It's a Dassault. It's French.
I keep calling it Dassault.
Yeah. Like, so assault. I figured at some point. Yeah. I figured at some point I'd correct you on the French so that they might get a Dassault Falcon.
Oh, Roger, je ne parle pas le français.
Oui. Huh?
I just said I don't speak French.
Oh. Who knew? So anyway, I mean, yeah, with the operations, you know, we've got two 2000s, the 900 Easy, and now the Gulfstream, and you know, it takes a lot of manpower to keep an operation that size metal going. Yeah. So.
Now, one of the traditional things I've always heard was that, you know, when an airline pilot or a professional airline pilot has maybe a furlough situation happening, or they find themselves between jobs for whatever reason, or maybe they've retired. I've always heard that it's very difficult for airline pilots to find a job in the corporate structure because of a preconceived notion that airline pilots are lazy, which you have now for 3.5 years have voiced your opinion of pretty much the same road. Is it that because the corporate pilot is involved with so many more aspects of the operation, and then when you put an airline pilot that is so used to having everything kind of done for them through these other ancillary departments that help the operation, is that a common thing? Do you think that's a true statement to say that they don't like hiring airline pilots?
You're really asking to get me into trouble here, aren't you? I guess here's my honest opinion about the whole thing. I think that it's heavily dependent on who is going to do the hiring. It's actually airline pilots, as they come out and transition, primarily it's from a retirement standpoint. Yes, sometimes it's from furlough also. They are very well respected from an experience standpoint, especially when you get into the bigger metal that is flying overseas trip, because that is all procedural. And if I can have a guy that has that experience and that procedural knowledge, that doesn't change from operation to operation. That's pretty virtually the exact same thing. We all operate the same way crossing over oceans. However, saying that airline pilots are lazy, you know, that's my something with the, yeah, sure, I'd say, you know, in my tongue in cheek, making fun of you guys. In reality, I don't think that's necessarily true. But there are elements of it that airline pilots are not, it's harder for them to transition because there is so much more work. And it's not because that they're lazy, but they're unprepared for it, or they flat out just don't know that it has to get done. And so things then get left behind. And then especially, you know, getting into a little bit more trouble here, the older that these people get and you get to post 65, you're trying to teach an old dog new tricks sometimes. And when you're talking about extremely wealthy people who want things done a certain way at a certain time, and then trying to teach somebody multiple new things, especially like, hey, I mean, as simple as is the flight plan filed. You know, there's just a lot of things that happen relatively quickly, and airline pilots, the longer that they stay there, the harder it is for them to transition just because of the sheer amount of stuff that needs to get done that used to be, quite frankly, spoon-fed to them.
Yeah.
And not that there's anything wrong with that, because that's the way the airlines work and everybody has their segregated, this is your department, this is your lane, stay in it. Mm-hmm. And it works generally fairly well. But all of a sudden those lanes get really blurry and it's kind of just this wide open. It's kind of like driving on a freeway in the United States versus going down to Mexico where people will just make their own lanes.
It's a suggestion, the lane.
It's a suggestion. You know, we all want to get there without crashing into each other, but there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. And so I think that it's not laziness. It's just trying to teach somebody a completely different way of operating airplanes. Yeah. And it is very different.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, and that's really what I was hoping to hear from you, is that, you know, there's these rumors that you hear, especially when you're starting out in the aviation industry and you're building your time and getting your ratings, and you hear, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to be? You know, what kind of job are you trying to get? And a lot of people say, well, I want to fly corporate, or I want to fly airlines, or I want to fly cargo, or they specifically name a particular airline that they want to fly for. I can remember some very young flight instructor told me that he wanted to be a Southwest Airlines pilot as soon as possible, and did everything in his power to try to leverage his career path to get there. And this happens, you know, we have these preconceived ideas, but we've also heard this, even when we were first starting out, you know, hey, if you go corporate, you know, they're going to work you hard. You're going to work hard and you're going to be 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And that's really the gist of the knowledge that I had. Here you are now being in the corporate field for over a decade, and I'm learning so much just listening to your story of your journey. And it kind of, I like how you dispel the fact that this rumor that, oh, they don't hire airline pilots. Well, yeah, they have a lot of respect for especially pilots that have the experience, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just that you don't want to end up with a person with expectations that aren't met. And the later that airline pilots get in life, the more their expectations. And I think that you guys have even seen that with, you know, you guys are flying, you know, with where you're at right now, the guys that you're flying with have been with an airline now for not years, for decades.
Decades, yeah.
And pulling somebody out of that mentality is kind of hard. It's kind of hard. And, yeah. You know, you were talking about that guy, you know, that flight instructor that, you know, when we're all young, we have these things that we think we want to do. And then, you know, things happen and you are exposed to more stuff. Quite frankly, when you're first starting out, you think you know what you want, but you really don't. And there's nothing wrong with that. And things will just change. But the longer that you are in one or the other, the more you get comfortable with that. And the more your expectations are, this is the way that it is, or this is the way that it should be. Mm-hmm. And then when you make a big change, like going from airlines to corporate, or just to a lesser degree, but still to some, from corporate to airlines, it is a different experience with a different set of expectations. And I do think generally is a little bit harder going from the airlines to corporate, but I would not say that it has anything to do with laziness.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, whose opinion I'd like to hear on this is Rob. So without further ado, let's introduce him. Also joining us today is a superb aviator and Squawk Ident podcast co-host. He's a former international professional racquetball champion, a member of the 9G Club, an AMP, an avionics tech, an RC aircraft commander, a boat skipper, commercial drone operator, and currently an Airbus pilot for Legacy Airlines. The name we use here on the show is an alias to our employer, a U.S. mainline carrier. Joining us from day one of a three-day trip from the Royal Sonesta in Boston, Massachusetts. Did I say that right? Massachusetts. Help us in joining our very own Mr. Rob D. Rob, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, that's the old Indian name for the state, I guess, Massachusetts. Yeah, I'm doing good, man. It's good to be back. Been working my butt off and finally get a good overnight here in Boston to go out and get some exercise and enough time to sit down and do a show with you guys.
Yeah, you know, and you know, we were talking to Captain Roger about, you know, this preconceived notion, especially when you're starting out in the industry, corporate versus airline. You know, what's the better route to take? If you go airline, can you go back to corporate? If you go corporate, how hard is it to get into airline? And we've all heard these rumors. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think what Roger said was very true, spot on. You know, honestly, you know, I sit here and I look back at my, you know, what's it now, 17 year so career in the industry, and you know, I lost a lot of like the regular GA knowledge of aviation, and you know, so, and obviously a lot of the rules have changed, especially with rest rules and stuff like that, and you know, I think back and you know, there's parts of GA that I miss and parts that I don't, and then you know, listening to Roger, you know, I remember there was a trip. I was jump seating from Phoenix to Dallas, and this was a few years ago. I was still with Sandpiper, and the air crew. Well, look at you, Tony.
Your head's Tony's like
cameras.
Your head's like
going. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's I'm.
We're just laughing.
You're like a floating head. Like,
yeah, just yeah, it's crazy. I'm getting it's on the table and it's just not at the right angle and there's no
just
like
comfortable man.
Ice chest to put it on. So yeah, I'm just trying to find it. So anyway, I was jump seating on an Airbus back to Dallas, and the crew I guess at this time Legacy had just gotten the Airbus on property, and the Legacy airline pilots side of the house, it was brand new airframe to them, because you know, they had it at America West, they had it at US Air, but you know, Legacy was, it was brand new to them. So these pilots had been flying like the 777 and the 7, you know, 7 whatever overseas for the last like 10 years or something like that. So this is like they really didn't fly the domestic side of the house.
Yeah.
You know, that often. So to get to where Roger was talking about, they had to divert into a small airport in North Texas called Wichita Falls.
Oh, yeah.
On a Sunday in the evening time. Airport is closed, no tower. These guys were as lost as can be. And I honestly, I felt so thankful I was actually in the cockpit, because I'm like, hey, dude, you got to switch to that frequency over there called the CTAF and tell them what you're doing, because there may be other airplanes landing here, you know, and they're like, oh, okay, good call, you know, and then they landed, and then the FO was like, man, I have no clue how to get a clearance out of here. You know, towers closed. I can't get a hold of ATC, air traffic control on the ground here. The frequency's not working. I was like, yeah, you might need to call. You might need to pick up the phone,
the radio,
and call 1-800-WX-BRIEF or call the nearest, you know, flight service station to get the clearance out of here. And he's like, yeah, I haven't done this in 20 years since about, you know, actually he was in the military, so he's never even done it with them.
Yeah.
So it was like, and you know, it just dawned on me exactly what Roger was talking about. You know, I think they know how to do it, but they just haven't done it in such a long time that the processes in their brains just don't start working until, you know, they've done it once or twice again. And, you know, that could be a challenge, especially in a high pace, you know, high demand environment that like Roger works in, you know, where, you know, you really, time is money to them, and, you know, you have really high expectations, from your customers and your owners. So, you know, I think, you know, obviously the experience flying the airplane and handling the airplane, that's like most people would, you know, get all tens on that side of the house. It's the actual, you know, administrative part of being a pilot and, you know, following their SOPs and processes that they need to have, that we're just, like he said, everybody, we have departments that handle so many different, you know, aspects of our job that we don't even think about it anymore. We just wait for a message to show up you know, in our messaging system to tell us, hey, you know, you need to go to training, or, you know, hey, you need to get your new medical again. So,
yeah, I think cost wise,
it's different. It's a different world.
Yeah. When you're dealing in a corporate structure, you're dealing with, you know, smaller aircraft, obviously a very small operation in comparison to even a small regional or a charter. So, you know, it doesn't make sense to have one person only that does only flight plans and fueling and maintenance, and then have only one person doing scheduling, and only have one person doing, you know, another aspect. It just makes sense to have the pilots handle all of it, because when you have four airplanes on property, you know, why are you going to go and hire all these other people? It that's not cost effective. But when you get into an airline business where, you know, you're on a schedule with minimal turn times, where you land, maybe there's a cruise drop, maybe not, and within 35 minutes you're back in the air, fully loaded, fully fueled, or however much fuel you need. All that's been calculated for you. The weather has been calculated for you. The routing, everything. Catering's been calculated. All that stuff. Meanwhile, Roger's
logistics,
doing it all himself.
Yeah.
So it makes sense when you have a multi-billion, if not trillion-dollar operation worldwide, to have you focus on your job. And us as pilots, what is it? We have to be in our seat, ready to go 20 minutes prior to departure. Completely, like, checklist done, everything ready to go. And sometimes we don't get there until 40 minutes prior to departure. So we have 20 minutes to do our pre-flight checks, our walk-arounds, our make sure we send the fuel, make sure we, you know, verify all the hazmat material that may or may not be there, the loads, you know, sign the release, check the weather, check the routing, brief the flight attendants, you know, brief any special passengers that might need a briefing. There's so many procedures that we just focus on just our part. And when it all comes together, it's actually quite beautiful. It's kind of like a zipper. Everybody does their part to bring it all together.
It is.
And but how many millions of dollars in payroll does that take? So,
oh, totally. I know the logistical part of it's amazing. And when one thing stops, it creates a, you know, a little ripple effect in the whole operation. And, you know, I go back to my military days and I think about, you know, in the military world, logistics is a huge, huge deal. You know, if the men and women fighting the war on the front lines, they can't do it, you know, forever. They need supplies. They need gas. They need ammo. They need intel. They need information. They need equipment. And that stuff, and they need food and all that stuff too. And all that stuff is, you know, brought up to the front line through a network. And if you want to cripple an army or a military, you take out the logistical part of their operation and you bring them to their knees. And that's how you start. That's how you, you know, slowly break them down and you defeat them. Well, it's the same thing with an airline. You know, the logistics part of it is a big deal. When we have these bad weather days, that's basically what breaks down is, you know, you get the airplane and the people there, but then, you know, once they're there, they can't move anymore. So, you know, you end up not having crews in place. You can't get your gas because the lightning is in the area. You can't unload the bags. Passengers are not connecting. And it's just turns into a big, big mess. And it's truly amazing how, you know, an operation as large as Legacies and, you know, all the other ones, how they can keep those things running as well as they do and recover after something like that, or even just on a normal day, how everything just runs, you know, hums along. Yeah, it's true. It's quite impressive.
Yeah. And that's what I think the news doesn't get right is they go, oh, it's a pilot shortage. That's why there's these delays and cancellations, pilot shortage. True. And though that's a true statement, like you said, the multitude of departments that are caught up with the logistics of flying a multi-million dollar airline, that's really, they have a huge role to play in all of this too, with these cancellations and delays.
Totally.
It's staffing from dispatchers to fuelers to caterers. I mean, it all plays a very significant role.
Totally. And Rob made one good point that I do want to kind of emphasize, because I danced around it, but he brought up the point. It's never about the flying. when you go from, you know, an airline pilot to a corporate pilot. It's never about the flying. If I was going to take an airline pilot, put him into the airplane, 100%, I'd be sure that we could transfer him over any kind of emergency that happened in the real world, that they'd be able to handle it. I talked about the procedural stuff from crossing over oceans. It's never, ever the flying. It's everything outside yeah. of the flying. Because when those other things don't happen, then like what you were just saying, it all just falls apart. And if the one person that holds it all together, which is the pilot in a corporate, I mean, the whole thing will unravel. And the other part of it is that, unfortunately, when I can take a guy that flies really well, the owners, they don't notice, they don't care. How often do you're going to have an in-flight emergency and the owner is going to go, oh man, thank goodness we had you on board. That doesn't really happen. But what they do see is when everything falls apart, or when there's no ice on the airplane, or yep. when there wasn't catering, or when all, that's a thing that happens every single flight, no matter how quick the turn. And that's the hard, that's the thing where that transition has a harder time taking place, but that's what everybody sees
yeah.
every yeah. single day.
Yep. And it's funny because, and I hate to admit it, I shouldn't say I'm admitting it, but it's, at least it's from my observation, it's very obvious that is how pilots think, especially airline pilots, especially military pilots. I shouldn't say especially military pilots, I take that back, but mostly most airline pilots, that's the way they think is, you know, they could do any aviation job because I could fly the crap out of an airplane.
Yep.
I'm like, that has nothing to do with the job. I mean, yes, that you have to be able to fly an airplane, don't get me wrong, but you have to be able to do everything else very well. And that's what makes a good pilot, is being able to incorporate everything that you have to do outside the cockpit, you know, before the flight, during the flight, and after the flight. And that's what yeah. makes a good crewman and everything else. And that was funny because it kind of goes along the same lines as what you were talking about there. The when something doesn't happen, you know, that's when the owners notice it. Well, that's how it is at my house. You know, when the internet drops off, you know, it doesn't matter. The toilet could be leaking, you know, the walls falling, the doors falling off the hinge. As soon as the internet goes off in my house, my
the world
kids
might
are like,
as well stop.
Oh my God, what the hell's going on? This thing sucks, you know?
Yeah, that's why I want to buy a cabin in the woods and periodically go up there for like a week with no internet, yeah. no cell, no nothing.
No, nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. Unplug. Get off the matrix.
Nice.
My God, man. Oh, thank you for sharing that, and thank you for your insight, Rob, as well. I couldn't agree more. Flying is such a small aspect. Just because you have a driver's license doesn't mean you should be driving a freaking Caterpillar, you know, or a semi-truck. Well, I can drive, yeah, but there's more to it than that. There's always these specific aspects of the jobs, the different jobs. So, yeah, thank you. Well, joining us right now, live from his IOE trip, is another co-host. So let's catch up with Alex and see how he's doing on his first trip of IOE at Sandpiper. Let's join in. Where are you, Alex?
I'm in Aguas Calientes.
Paradise.
You're live from Mexico, Aguas Calientes, sitting next to your IOE Czech airman
mm-hmm.
on a trip on IOE, and your flight's delayed.
Yep.
Any reason? Well, have you figured out how to check?
Probably. I'll figure it out when we get on the plane. It was late getting out of Dallas, so probably an issue with the plane getting out of Dallas or some connecting flight issue.
Nice. And what is your IOE experience? How is that going right now?
It's pretty good. I'm actually picking up the PM side of the house pretty quick. Flying side, little rough on some areas here and there, but the landings are a bit of a struggle right now because it's different, the different feel and just completely different sight picture than what you're looking at in the sim. So
this is your first trip, isn't it?
Yeah,
like your very first one.
First trip of IOE, and I am
good for you, man. That's awesome.
I'm loving this because you know somebody gave me a lot of shit when I was in the airplane of the 172 after 15 years, and he was telling me, "And you're an Airbus pilot, and you can't land a 172. Isn't it all the same?" And now I'm like, "Oh, I'm having trouble with my landings." Okay, so I'm gonna get it.
Okay, you know what? It's my second time ever flying the airplane. Okay.
Yeah. Do you have a radar altimeter that talks to you and tells you how far off the ground you are?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, if the 172 so just listen,
that's ha- that's what I do. I mean, I got the three different airplane. I got three different airplanes now. I just wait till it goes to about 10, and that means pull. So when you get to 10, close your eyes and pull. It'll be fine.
You know what? I'm gonna take your advice and not follow it.
Yeah. At 10, those wings will flex.
Well, we went over hard landings a couple episodes ago, right?
Don't knock it till you try it.
My IOE captain had told me about 30 feet, that's when you start, you know, pulling your throttles back, and that's when you start pulling with it. Not at 10 feet, Roger.
How's that been working for you?
You know,
see?
Not good, but... But I don't need to be lower. That's the problem. I don't need to lawn dart it into the
runway.
Try
50. You know, it's different. It depends on how hard you pull, you know?
Wait, your aircraft has throttles?
Yes. Oh, sorry.
Oh, give the kid a break. Oh. Oh.
Man, it's been a rough night. I have some shit in my eyes.
As he's giving me the bird, ladies and gentlemen, the bird. You know, the finger. Oh, Alex.
Yeah,
so,
you know, the finger. Oh, I hate it when it does that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So what does your Czech airman say about your experience so far? Is he having a lot of words of encouragement for you or a lot of pointers that you didn't maybe learn in ground school that he's able to convey out there on the line?
Yeah, he's given me like good, solid advice, like just overall, you know, like what to look for, what to not look out for, how to use more of the iPad app, the CCI app that we all use. He showed me, because we don't get to experience it when we're in the schoolhouse, is actually the ACARS side of the FMS and being able to pull your information and send your information and all that stuff. So that was pretty awesome. He's actually a local guy too. He's from East LA.
Oh.
So, and he just got this is his, so I'm his first trip, right? And he's on his last trip with Sandpiper.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's a pretty eventful thing. Is he flowing through to Legacy?
No, he got a CJO for Acme.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The airline that Captain Jeff flies for.
Yes, who Captain Jeff, by the way, I just received part of the Patreon account that I have with APG. He's sending video logs. He's on the road going to AirVenture right now as we speak.
Oh,
they're
nice.
Setting up a nice booth this year. The whole APG crew is going to be at AirVenture. So I'm looking forward to doing that. Every year I say the same thing. I've been saying the same thing for probably 20 years. Next year I'm going to Oshkosh. I've got to make it happen. Even we talked about this last year on the show. We're like, hey, next year we should just plan a trip and rent an RV and go to Oshkosh. And life happens at Mach 2, man.
It's yeah, no kidding. I you blink and it's here.
Yeah.
That's how it is. Well,
I'm looking forward to hearing about Oshkosh. Maybe we can get some of our listeners and maybe even some former guests to send in some audio feedback from the event. I know last year John sent us some really cool audio feedback. Maybe I can get him to send us some more. By the way, ACARS, for those listeners out there that may not be in the airline aviation industry, ACARS is the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System. It is a digital data link system for transmission of short messages between aircraft and ground stations via an airband radio or satellite, aka text messaging. So that's how dispatch sends us text messages, basically, to the aircraft. Or we can request automated messages like the automated ATIS, PDC, which is the pre-departure clearance that we can receive in the on the flight deck. It just prints out on our printer. We can print things, send messages, and receive reports and TAFs and things like that. So, yeah, in the simulator, it's there. You can go through the motions, and they even have a way that the simulator instructor can send you messages, but it's not the actual ACARS system. It's a computer software program. So, yeah, out there on the line, it's the first experience a pilot will have with the system. So I know you mentioned that earlier. Also, one thing that some people might not realize, which we always got a chuckle of, was the first time you actually get to fly the aircraft, you usually have a load of, you know, passengers in the back, right?
Yep.
Full load. So if only the passengers knew, this is the first officer's first ever landing, ladies and gentlemen. How would the pucker factor be on that one?
They all figured it out at the
end. Shit out of people from flying.
Yeah, Roger was saying it. They all figure it out. Yeah. Yeah, and we've all had those. You know, I've had the flight attendant say, well, ladies and gentlemen, after that landing, your items for sure have shifted in the overhead bins.
So I flew back on a legacy carrier just the other day. I'm pretty sure it was that guy's first Airbus landing. I didn't know you could land an Airbus as hard as that guy landed.
Really?
I was impressed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you make a comment as you exited the aircraft?
I did not. The door. It was one of those landings. Now, granted, I was near the front of the plane, but the flight deck door had not opened yet.
Ah, yes. Yeah, the delaying of the flight deck.
It was one of those.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. So there was no there. It wouldn't have done any good to make a comment about it.
No. When it happened to me.
Here's a fun fact. I think it's anything over what 2.5 G's.
Yeah, is that what we determined? Yeah.
ACARS message.
Well, I think over 2.5 G's. That's a crash.
Hey, there was a plane in our maintenance that was 3.4 G's.
Whoa!
And it looked completely normal.
Oh my God.
Well, so the story behind it is they went to report it, right? The landing, they had a hard landing. So they did their due diligence, said, hey, we had a hard landing. Maintenance came out and they pulled the FOQA data, and FOQA said that was a 3.4 G landing.
Oh my God. So your 70,000 pound airplane now landed at 250,000 pounds.
Yes.
Yep. Talk about X-raying wing spars and fuselage wrinkles and laser scoping the whole thing. And, yeah. And you probably have to change both the pilot seats, too, because I'm sure they're full of shit.
Probably. Well, gentlemen, I see my plane pulling in. Oh, yeah. Oh, so this is – I got to show you guys this. So in Mexico, this is kind of awesome. Sorry, I'm trying to figure out how to take off the background blur. So, in Mexico, this is how many people work a flight. And this is mild right now. Just wait. So, there's our plane coming in.
Oh, look at that. So, you have an Embraer 175 and a beautiful livery right there. Approaching the gate, and you have a team.
There's at least, I can count, probably 10 people, mm-hmm. at least right now, just out there.
Yep, they're going to do they probably already did the FOD check. And you have those two ladies right there with the reflective vest and the white shirts of security. They're going to be with the aircraft until it pushes back out. They'll check your badge randomly. Yep. And my favorite, and if I don't know if you've experienced this yet, Alex, but take a note on the pushback, what they do. It is something when I saw it for the first time. Uh-huh. When I saw it for the first time, I thought, wow, that is so cool.
Yeah, me too.
Yep. Okay, I'll pay more attention today. I was heads down yesterday.
Yeah, they don't normally do it on the taxi in, but on the pushback, usually every Mexico destination, they go through a particular procedure. I won't spoil it for you. And just take a note on how they're lined up. I'll just say that.
Okay.
Yeah, look at that. And so, Alex, here, how exciting. Your first trip on IOE, you're sharing with us. Thank you so much. Please thank your Czech airman. for allowing you to take this opportunity out of your schedule on your first IOE trip while you're in Aguascalientes, watching your aircraft come in, taxi in. Let's see how close they get it to the T. Approaching, the guideman is given. Oh, they're still rolling.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. Yep, and a lot of Mexico destinations don't use jet bridges, as we can see here on the video. They use air stairs.
Yep.
So once the parking brake is set, they're chalking the aircraft. That's the very next step. The guideman down there is giving the indication that the chocks are in. Then the pilot will give them a thumbs up, usually, and then they'll start bringing over the air stairs and usually a ground power unit and the belt loaders, and they'll start working and servicing the aircraft both below and above wing. Yeah. That's the baggage, the fuel. Sometimes there's a maintenance walk around that's happening. Most of the time, not happening in some of the smaller outstations, but they'll always ask you, is everything okay with the aircraft? Because they don't want to delay because of that. Yep. Yeah, they are pushing the stairs over.
They're really good at SOPs there. They notice nobody approaches the airplane until the airplane is shut down and the chocks are in place.
Yep.
Yep. Good safety precaution.
Very noticeable there. Getting fired up.
Yep. And if you want to see what happens when a ramper jumps the gun and approaches the aircraft before both engines are secured, just do a Google search on a traffic cone gets sucked into an Embraer 175 engine in Chicago.
Chicago. Yep.
Brand new airplane.
I think it was Republic. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And there it is. That's pretty much it. Everybody's got the air stairs going. They're going to open the door here shortly. And yeah. So there's at least.
Hey, you want in pressure check, airman? Just tell them the flight's complete. You did it from the gate, so you're good to go.
Well, and also we now have a picture of the airplane before Alex flew it. Anything that happens, we know what it looked like before.
All right, gentlemen, I'm going to get going because I know we're going to get kicking and moving here soon.
Well, fly safe, man. Have fun.
What a fantastic experience. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And good luck.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'll let you guys know how it goes. I got, we're flying from here, Dallas, Springfield. And then tomorrow morning, Springfield back to Dallas. And then I'm done and deadhead home.
Excellent.
So,
well, let us know when you get back. Enjoy.
We really
all right, keep you guys posted. Thanks, guys.
Have to get going.
Yes, we do. Bye, guys.
See you, Alex.
Bye.
Bye.
Wow, what a treat.
That's cool. His
first trip.
And he's on a podcast.
And he's on a
podcast. Yeah,
that's dedication. Hey, we were there one day. We were there at one point. That was cool.
Yeah.
That was a fun time.
Should I hit record?
Matter of fact, my first trip was from where I'm at right now, Boston, to D.C., in an empty Embraer 135.
Empty.
What a memorable moment that was. Empty.
Well, what happened there? Was it a ferry flight?
Well, basically it was a ferry reposition. When we did, you know how the first trip with your IOE check airman, the check airman does a walk around with you. And at the time, we were also in the process of, you know, first flight of the day, we had to open up certain panels, check for, you know, security related things. And when we opened up the hydraulic panel, we saw the hydraulic bypass pin popped.
Yeah.
On the walk around. So he's like, well, you know, normally you wouldn't open up that panel in the middle of the day because it's not a first flight of the day, but since we did and we saw that, we got to call that in and write it up.
Right.
I was like, yeah, roger that. So, which, you know, they delayed the flight. They ended up rebooking everybody on the next flight. Well, maintenance repaired the one that we were going to fly. And then we ended up ferrying that airplane like 4 hours later to DC, and it was empty. So it was just flight crew on board only.
Yeah.
And landed in DC, the empty airplane. Then we filled it right up and, you know, flew the next flight out. I think it was to like Nashville or Raleigh-Durham. I think it's Raleigh-Durham. But yeah, the first flight was memorable because it was empty, it was maintenance, and it was, you know, Boston to DC. So,
oh my god, and a 135 empty, it's like a rocket ship.
Empty,
yeah.
Tell me about it. Yeah, so it was like, it was literally my first time flying a jet in RJ. Obviously, we did it in the sim and all that, but not empty. You know, it didn't have any of that stuff going on. So,
yeah,
that thing was like a rocket ship. It climbed like a, it was awesome.
Yeah, yeah. That's a
but you don't really realize it at the time because it's your first time and you're just trying to fly, you know, follow the flight director. So you just pulling. I'm like, well, I guess this is normal.
And then you end up on the next flight on a 145 full of passengers and at max takeoff weight. And you're like, how come it's not accelerating?
Yeah, what's going on? We have all engines going out there.
Yeah.
It's like flying an Airbus. Yeah. Hey. Like flying a 321.
And we'll be right back right after these messages. Well, again, I just want to say thank you to Alex for taking a moment from his IOE experience with his Czech airman. Really cool to see all that. So, you know, Alex is having a great time. You know, we really appreciate joining in on his journey live, basically, as it's happening. He text messaged me, the group, that we have this group text with all our Squawk Ident crew. And he says, yeah, I'm on my first leg of IOE. It was last night. And you know, got going. And I said, enjoy hanging from the tail. It's a common common thing that we used to talk about with our IOE
the static
students.
Wicks, yeah.
Yeah, they're hanging on by the tail or the static wicks because they're so far behind the aircraft, which is absolutely normal. Every Czech airman
absolutely
knows this. Yep. And we do our best to calm the nerves and keep it lighthearted and keep it, you know, productive, because we want them to get something out of the experience and not just feel overwhelmed. And we're talking about hanging on by the tail, and then Roger shoots me a video. I'm like, oh yeah, talk about hanging from the tail. And Roger, what was going on in that video?
So I couldn't help it, and this just popped into my head. Is we're I don't remember where I was, and he's talking about hanging onto the tail, and the Gulfstream is a beast. And for the first time ever, we climbed up to 470 last week, except at the same time, and this is the video I shot Captain Tony, we were climbing out of, I think, 45 or 46 at Mach 8.5, climbing up to, through 45,000 feet up to 470. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, Alex wants to talk about hanging on to the tail. Here we are at 45 and we're still climbing faster than his plane can even go in a descent, which yeah. I just couldn't help just thinking of that and shot that video over.
Yeah. At 1,000 feet a minute, mind you.
Oh,
yeah,
at 1,000 feet a minute.
You know, the Airbus, when we're reaching our service ceiling, whatever that may be with our current weight, you do 200-300 feet a minute. If that,
we were doing all right. It's an amazing airplane. It can go max gross weight right up to 41. Climb it at Mach 8.8, 300 to transition to Mach 8.8. Get the cruise, let it get up to 9.0. Just
yeah,
and just go.
Talk about a rocket.
It's an amazing airplane.
Now, is the 650 the world's most advanced corporate aircraft?
At this point, no. I mean, that's kind of a little bit of a loaded question also. The 650 is definitely famous, not because of how advanced it is, but just the sheer size and the speed of it and the range, how far you can fly. Now, it has now been surpassed by the Global 7500. It's also been surpassed by Gulfstream's own. They have a Gulfstream 700, G700 that's flying now, which are more advanced. But the Gulfstream, the 650 definitely for almost a decade held that, you know, that mental or emotional title of, you know, the fastest airplane. It's got several records. because of its 9.0 speed that it can do. And it's a large airplane. It's just, but I would actually also kind of argue that the Dassault products are smarter. And a lot of it's just, I think, an engineering mentality that the French, when they built, you know, even in the Mirage and the jets that they built, they spent a lot of time thinking about, maybe for lack of better terms, how dumb pilots are. And let's try and make this as simple for the dumb pilots as possible. Versus the Gulfstream, you know, coming from the Grumman Ironworks, and where it's like, we're going to have people, you know, physically move and physically touch things. You know, I think the Airbus is the same way, just like the Dassault is like, when you're in the air, you have a dark cockpit, right?
Yeah.
Like none of the light should be on. And the Gulfstream, some of them are on, some of them stay on, some of them, when they're not lit, they're off. And sometimes when they're lit, they stay on. But I mean, it's, you know, you just, and you get used to it because, you know, that's how they live and that's what it is. But, you know, a dark cockpit would be bad. I mean, you've got generators off. We've got, you know, the lights in the Gulfstream. We have a light in the switch that says on. Well, why? You know, I don't know. But it's, you know, just kind of admittedly stupid and trivial stuff like that. But I really would actually argue that the Dassault products are a little bit more advanced, or maybe even smarter, even though the plane might be 10 years older. But really, it comes down to engineering, the engineering thought process behind it.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the dark cockpit philosophy in that, and that's a term that I didn't really hear much of. I did remember a little bit of it in my Embraer training, and that also has kind of the similar philosophy. But it wasn't until I got onto the Airbus at Legacy that it was kind of explained to me in a manner in which I got it. And I just looked it up just to make sure. It's an aviation concept, the dark cockpit, not because the lights are off and you're flying in the dark. It's a concept that, or a term that they use for a situation when, except for the ambient and instrument lighting, no other lights, no cautions, no amber lights, no warnings or red lights are on. Dark cockpit means everything is fine and working as planned. All the switches are dark. All the buttons are dark. Now, if something illuminates in a dark cockpit, then it should catch your eye immediately. And if something is being overridden, or a fault, or not in the proper place. And it just, philosophy-wise, it makes sense. And not all aircraft manufacturers and aircraft engineers follow the dark cockpit concept. Like you mentioned, there are manufacturers out there that feel like, you know, especially Boeing, toggle switch is better because it's a tactile feel, a tactile response. And knowing the position of that switch, when a pilot flies that aircraft and they're a master of that aircraft, they should know what position the switch is in at all times. And it's more of a tactile cockpit versus a visual or conceptual cockpit. So yeah, they're two different schools of thought. And really, if you really want to have an argument, let's talk about why Boeing and Airbus pilots constantly
say, I bet Rob would be the guy to chime in on this, because he's flown both the Boeing and the Airbus now.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I love the Airbus. I love the way it from the pilot's point of view, how you operate it. It's, you know, very comfortable. It's very easy to fly. Its flows are very, they make sense. You know, the Boeing isn't that bad either. It's just, it's very old. It's just the way they have that plane design, and it's very old. It works, and they haven't changed it because it works. And it's a very good performer, but it's still a 60s design cockpit. And back then they weren't thinking about ergonomics and comfort when they designed that airplane, at least not as much as they refined it in the Airbus. So it's such a different way to fly when you go from a 73 or a Boeing to an Airbus. I'd say, I know the Boeing products later on, like the 787, and I think definitely the 777 are closer to what an Airbus is like.
Well, I was going to say, how much do you think, as I think I've heard this somewhere, that because, like, yeah, you said that the 73 is, I mean, a 60s era design, but to keep, yeah, a similar type, even up to the 737, 900 or 1,000 or whatever they're up to, the max. Mm-hmm. But to keep the similar type, don't they kind of need to keep most of those, that overhead panel, as antiquated as it seems? Does it have to stay that way for that?
I don't know all the details behind that. Obviously, there's so much more to it than what I know. But, during the certification process or during the design process of the new MAX, 737 MAX, the intent was to design the airplane so that it can compete with the Airbus products, but also retain the same type certification that was in place for all the other previous designs. Basically, they didn't want anybody to have to go through a simulator training or a different type certification for the new 737. So I don't think it has so much to do with the overhead. Maybe it does. It's all the same, basically. I mean, there's very little differences between the new MAX and the current, the 800 series, the 700, the 600. And actually, if you look at pictures of a 737 from the 1960s, the overhead panel, the center pedestal, pretty much everything, all the major controls are the same. There's actually on the 737, there's some overhead cutouts for other instruments that were also incorporated into like the Boeing 727 and the 707. So they used this, in order to keep the costs down in the manufacturing, they kept using the same, cutouts or machine and tooling that they used for those airplanes on the 737. They just omitted some of those parts. So,
And Rob and I, when I had the privilege to spend an evening with you and your family, we sat down over some cold cervezas, and we watched a documentary mm-hmm. on the 737 MAX grounding of the aircraft and why it happened. And you told me, we're gonna watch this and you're gonna get angry, you're gonna get pissed off. And I was like, okay. Yeah. And then we watched it, and I was really angry, because as a pilot, we believe that every aspect of aviation and its triple redundancy of every system is always there for safety. Safety first, safety first. That is the mission statement and the corporate mentality for almost every aviation company I've ever heard of. And watching this documentary, do you remember what it was called, Rob?
Downfall.
Yeah.
Downfall. Yep. It's on Netflix.
If you haven't watched it, listener, I definitely
highly recommend it.
Yeah. It's a documentary. So don't expect, popcorn and explosion and stuff, but it's very eye opening and it's a little upsetting. But what I learned watching that with you was that McDonnell Douglas, a major American aerospace manufacturer, corporation and defense contractor, formed by the merger of McDonnell Aircraft and Douglas Aircraft Company in 1967. Between then mm-hmm. and its own merger with Boeing in 1997, it produced a number of well-known commercial and military aircraft, such as the DC-10, the F-15 Fighting Eagle, Air Superiority Fighter, the MD-80, the FA-18 Hornet, multi-role fighter. If you watched the new Top Gun, isn't that the F-18 in there? Yeah.
That's a Hornet, yeah.
Yep. And what's really was part of what got me upset watching that documentary is that they were alluding to the fact that after that merger happened with Boeing in 97, the corporate structure and the philosophy was always safety first. If any employee at all, from the top engineer mm-hmm. to the janitor cleaning toilets, anyone that sees any safety issue, they immediately told their supervisor and everything stopped until it was corrected. After the merger, they removed that aspect. They said that that cost too much money and production has a time frame and it has to continue on time.
Right.
Everything has to be done on time. And some of the safety
deadlines.
Whistleblowers, for a lack of a better term, were then ignored
or shut out or even fired or let go. And that's the part that just drives you nuts, yeah. Because now you have a company that's being run by corporate operators that are not safety conscious, that are letting things slip through the cracks for profit, for stock price, for market share. And it's very unfortunate and very telling of why the events happened when they did and how they did.
With the Max. Yeah. And one of the things that was memorable in the documentary was after that whole corporate shift took place, one of the comments from, I believe it was one of the engineers they were talking about was that when it was Boeing's headquarters was in Seattle, and the engineers and everybody were in close proximity to the decision makers and everything like that, where it got to a point where there were so many red flags being raised that the decision makers were like, hey, I don't want to hear about all this stuff. You guys just figure it out. Here's the deadline. And then it got to a point where they said, you know what? We're actually thinking about moving our office now to Chicago. And, you know, we're going to build a building out there. And the mindset was, the thinking was, that's so they can get away from the engineers and they didn't have to be so involved with everything that they were talking about, which separated all that. And now you created that division, that breakdown in communication and, you know, from the business side of the house and to what's actually happening, you know, on the floor. And, you know, they think that was one of the big straws that broke the camel's back, you know, in the company. So it was crazy.
Yeah. And I really do hope that the Boeing company can figure this all out and come out on top. Boeing is an American company that has been around since, you know, you and I were born. They really are a superior airline, or should I say manufacturer, an aviation or airplane manufacturer. And to see them kind of go down this corporate America structure of profits before safety is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And we as pilots really hope that they can turn it around in the next few years. Kyle keeps posting articles on the Aviation Business Information Board on Facebook. If you're not already on that page, I highly recommend that you do a quick search. And I believe there's a link on our website as well, down under shared communities. I think there's a link to his board on Facebook. And he posts all these wonderful articles. They're articles all from reputable aviation news outlets, and a lot of every day. They're talking about Boeing and being able to
and get manufacturing. I do manufacturing. Know that Boeing is... Yeah, they're working on it. I know that they're having a, you know, they're recovering from the whole Max situation. And as a matter of fact, that's something, some news that just came out within a couple of days, that they just signed a huge deal with I think a U.S. carrier for the Max 10. And if I'm not mistaken, it was with what's the company known as out of Atlanta.
Acme.
Thank you. Acme. I believe it's with Acme. Yeah, I think they just signed a deal with the new Max 10s, and that's been one of the things now, is Boeing is having a hard time certifying the Max 10s, and they're having manufacturing problems with the 787s, and I think it's called the KC-46, the military variant of the 767, I believe. They're still having issues with that whole thing, and I think it all stems back to, you know, the pre-Max accident stuff that the management, and they're still trying to get all that stuff going. But look, hey, Boeing's a big company. You know, they don't just have the, you know, the commercial division, commercial aircraft division. You know, they have the military side, satellites, you know, communication systems. I mean, it is a huge, huge business. So, you know, it's yes, it is an American company, and I want them to succeed. And, you know, I like to buy American and fly American, but hey, these guys need to get their business together.
Yeah.
Gain some trust back from the public.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, you know, Legacy's still waiting on those 787s. That's a big delay on their half for international flying. They're way behind schedule on that. And that's, we're supplementing some of the schedules with Airbuses because they don't have enough 787s to fly internationally. So, you know, they're doing what they can.
Yeah, and one of these simple flying articles that I found on the Aviation Business Information Board, it concludes in what we're talking about, the article that you mentioned. At the end, it says, you know, so while the figures are not official, there could be around 100 Boeing 787s and 100 Boeing 737 MAXs built and available for delivery in the second half of this year, depending on regulator and customer acceptance. Until those aircrafts are delivered and accounted for, there's no clear leader in this two-horse race, but perhaps Boeing may wind up ahead and by a decent margin when this year ends. Possibly there will be a humble pie on the Christmas menu. So They really feel like Boeing is going to, you know, come back. A lot of these Boeings are going to China. The 737 MAX aircraft, the customers are in China. So that could be huge.
And I think it's because they're offering a really good deal on them.
Yeah. And what's next?
You know what I mean?
Will we see? I mean, Something has to be made to replace the 7576. I mean, that was a cargo workhorse. That you could take a lot of cargo and passengers on those aircraft. Do we have a 797 maybe on the horizon? I don't know.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you know, new aircraft designs, and speaking of, you know, Roger's, was it transonic Mach 0.9? Isn't that transonic? It's more than hypersonic.
I guess that probably is somewhere in the transonic range.
At the bottom of the transonic range. That's fast, man. We see these concepts all the time, but there are other aircraft manufacturing. We talked about this probably about a year ago, that United announced a partnership with an aircraft manufacturer called Boom, something like that, which I think is a terrible name, by the way, for an airplane. But we're talking supersonic flight. Now, if you get your airline's pilot certificate or your ATP air transport certificate and you become an airline pilot and you're young, you're in your 20s and 30s, it's possible that before you retire, you might find yourself behind the wheel of one of these supersonic jets flying for an airline, no doubt. In an article from boomsonic.com, released on July 19th, 2022, I'll put a link in the show notes for those that want to follow up on it. It says, it's about time for a bold new era of supersonic flight. Meet the refined design of Overture. That's the parent company. Overture, the world's fastest airliner, optimized for speed, safety, and sustainability. Wonder if it's green. Are they using biofuel in that? Interesting. The Overture is the first airliner in a new era of sustainable supersonic flight. Flights at twice the speed of today's passenger airlines, Overture opens the door to a dramatically more accessible world where we can experience firsthand more people, places, and cultures. Now, this is not the first time we've had supersonic flight ideas. The Concorde, and many of our listeners probably weren't even alive when the Concorde was out flying. And remember those?
Yeah.
They were boasting how expensive British Airways tickets were on the Concorde. You can make it from London to JFK in how many hours? Like half the time?
I don't remember. 2 hours or something like that, or 4 hours.
Two or 3 hours, 4 hours. Yeah. And the tickets were like $1,500 a person. And the fuselage is smaller than like most regional jets nowadays. So it's a tight little airplane.
Yeah.
You can barely stand up in it. And at the time, $1,500 was a lot. Now it's like, you know, I want an Xbox. Oh, $1,500. I don't know. I have no idea. But yeah, supersonic flight. And the other concept that I'm interested about is the blended wing concept. I really think that would be really super cool to fly, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, military fighters have a lot of that incorporated into them, the blended body, the blended wing concept. And it's yet to be introduced into an airliner yet, but you know, I think that's the way of the future. According to Howard Hughes, it's the way of the future.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, definitely the way of the future. Yeah. Now, the Overture aircraft will carry between 65 and 80 passengers, like I said, like a regional jet, and run on 100% sustainable aviation fuel, or SAFs. It will fly Mach 1.7 over water with a range of about 4,250 nautical miles. Its design elements are expertly engineered for peak supersonic performance, and it will go into production in 2024. There you go. Mm. And for a deeper look on the Overture specifications, the cruise speed will be, as mentioned, 1.7 supersonic Mach. There it is. 0.94 is subsonic. To answer Roger's question earlier, we talked about the range. We talked about the passengers. The exterior dimensions of this aircraft. It has a length of 201 feet. That's pretty long. Wingspan of 106 feet, height of 36 feet. Gull wing with digital leading and trailing edge flap controls. Flight controls are by four redundant digital fly-by-wire system on two LRUs. The power plant will be four engines, medium bypass, 100% SAF-compatible turbofans. What does that mean? Well, a medium bypass is the size of the circumference of the N1 fan blade, the big fan that you see at the front of any turbine engine. And so most airliners nowadays, especially the big boys, have high bypass turbofan engines, meaning a huge fan in the front. And then the turbine is much smaller and the compressor is much smaller than the shaft of the engine. By doing this, you're using, I think the Embraer Rolls-Royce engines was what, about 86% of its thrust was produced by the high bypass N1 fan?
Yeah. I don't remember the actual percentage, but it was pretty high.
Pretty high in there. Yeah. I don't know what the Airbus.
I think pretty much most of them are like that.
Yeah. So a medium bypass is a much more narrow engine, kind of like a Screamer, those old Screamer jets. Zero carbon, 100% SAF fuel. And so I'm telling you, man, invest today in SAF fuel companies.
I wonder where they're building those things.
That's a good.
I'm trying to look on their website. They don't say it, but just kind of curious where they're building it. That'd be kind of neat to see. Maybe it's like an Airbus. You know, they're kind of piecing them together in facilities, and then they're going to assemble them in one place. But yeah, it's pretty neat.
Yeah, I haven't really dug into that, but might be worth a future episode to kind of find out more about this aircraft manufacturing process for the Overture. Again, just, you know, as a airline pilot in general, the whole idea of the concept of zero carbon emission, four engine aircraft that can fly supersonic is pretty cool. I'd love to fly one of those.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, the last thing we wanted to talk about here on the show today was a brief history on an airport that ranks up there in the U.S. as one of the busiest airports in the country. Kind of goes between number two, number three. We're going to find out a little bit about this airport. And of course, I'm talking about one that's near and dear to my heart. The Los Angeles International Airport, also known as LAX, has an ICAO of Kilo Lima Alpha X-ray. Commonly referred to as LAX, it's the primary international airport serving Los Angeles and its surrounding metropolitan area. Located in the Westchester neighborhood of Los Angeles, 18 miles southwest of downtown Los Angeles, with the commercial and residential areas of Westchester to the north and the city of El Segundo to the south. Yes, I left my wallet there. And the city of Inglewood to the east. LAX is the closest airport to the west side and the South Bay. The airport is operated by LAWA, or the Los Angeles World Airports, a branch of the LA city government. that also operates Van Nuys airports for general aviation. The airport covers 3,500 acres of land and has four parallel runways.
In 2019, LAX handled 88,068,013 passengers,
whoa,
making it the world's third busiest and United States' second busiest airport, following Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport. As the largest and busiest international airport on the U.S. West Coast, LAX is a major international gateway to the United States and also serves a connection point for passengers traveling internationally, such as East and Southeast Asia, Australasia, Mexico, and Central America. I've never actually heard of that before.
Yeah, me neither.
The airport holds the record for the world's busiest origin and destination airport because relative to other airports, many more travelers begin or end their trips in Los Angeles than use it as a connection. It is also the only airport to rank among the top five U.S. airports for both passenger and cargo traffic. LAX serves as a major hub or focus city for more passenger airlines than any other airport in the United States.
Although LAX is the busiest airport in the greater Los Angeles area, several other airports, including Hollywood Burbank Airport, John Wayne Airport, Long Beach Airport, Ontario International Airport, and San Bernardino International Airport, also serve the region, which are the airports, incidentally, that I generally fly into.
Excellent.
Much more than LAX.
Yeah, well, landing fees, right?
Actually, it wasn't horrible. I was actually just in LA a couple weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Nice. Yeah,
it wasn't. It wasn't horrible.
What's that landing fee at LAX? Do you know?
I could tell you. Stand by.
He's got the information at his fingertips.
And does it depend on the airplane, or like if you land in a 172, yeah, is it cheaper than if you land?
Yeah, it's definitely $450.
How much space you take up?
$450 to land
35,
a Dassault.
35. That was a 2,000. 35 for a security fee, which that doesn't really change by airplane, and 415 for the facility fee.
But if you buy gas, it's that waived.
Yeah, you can get it waived with. Usually it's around 400 gallons of fuel.
Oh.
So fuel's usually pretty expensive.
Wow.
We did not get fuel.
Right. Yeah, so if you're going to fuel 13 gallons in your Baron, it's not probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Granted, it won't be $400. Well, a little brief history about LAX. In 1926, the LA City Council and the Chamber of Commerce recognized the need for the city to have its own airport to tap into the fleeting but quickly growing aviation industry. Several locations were considered, but the final choice was a 640-acre field in the southern part of Westchester. The location had been promoted by real estate agent William W. Mines, and Mines Field, as it was known, had already been selected to host the 1928 National Air Races. On August 13, 1928, the city leased the land, and the newly formed Department of Airports began converting the field once used to grow wheat, barley, and lima beans into dirt landing strips. The airport opened on October 1, 1928, and the first structure, Hangar No. 1, was erected in 1929. The building still stands at the airport, remaining in active use and listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Over the next year, the airport started to come together. The dirt runway was replaced with an all-weather surface, and more hangars, a restaurant, and a control tower were built. On June 7, 1930, the facility was dedicated and renamed Los Angeles Municipal Airport.
The airport was used by private pilots and flying schools, but the city's vision was that Los Angeles would become the main passenger hub for the area. However, the airport failed to entice any carriers away from the established Burbank Airport or the Grand Central Airport in Glendale. World War II put a pause on any further development of the airport for passenger use. Before the United States entered the war, the aviation manufacturers located around the airport were busy providing aircraft for the Allied powers, while the flying schools found themselves in high demand. In January 1942, the military assumed control of the airport, stationing fighter planes at the airfield and building naval gun batteries in the ocean dunes to the west. Meanwhile, airport managers published a master plan for the land and in early 1943 and convinced voters to back a $12.5 million bond for airport improvements. With a plan and funding in place, the airlines were finally convinced to make the move.
After the end of the war, four temporary terminals were quickly erected on the north side of the airport, and on December 9th, 1946, American Airlines, TWA, United Airlines, Southwest Airways, and Western Airlines began passenger operations at the airport, with Pan Am Airways joining the next 1 month. The airport was renamed Los Angeles International Airport in 1949. The temporary terminals would remain in place for 15 years, but quickly became inadequate, especially as air travel entered the jet age and other cities invested in modern facilities. Airport leaders once again convinced voters to back a $59 million bond on June 5, 1956. The current layout of the passenger facilities was established in 1958 with a plan to build a series of terminals and parking facilities arranged in the shape of the letter U in the central portion of the property. The original plan called for the terminal buildings connected at the center of the property by a huge steel and glass dome. The dome was never built, but a smaller theme building built in the central area became a focal point for people coming to the airport.
The first of the new passenger buildings, Terminal 7 and 8, were opened for United Airlines on June 25, 1961, following opening festivities that lasted several days. Terminals 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 opened later that same year. A major expansion of the airport came in the early 1980s, ahead of the 1984 Summer Olympic Games. In November of 1983, a second level roadway was added. Terminal 1 opened in January of 1984, and the Tom Bradley International Terminal opened in June of 1984. The original terminals also received expansions and updates in the 1980s. Since 2008, the airport has been undergoing another major expansion. All of the terminals are being refurbished, and the Tom Bradley International Terminal was completely rebuilt with the West Gates Concourse added. Outside of the terminal area, a 4,300-stall parking structure, a Los Angeles Metrorail station, and a consolidated rental car facility are being built. All will be connected to the terminal area by the Los Angeles Automated People Mover. In the near future, airport managers plan to build two more terminals, 0 and 9. Altogether, these projects are expected to cost $14 billion and bring LAX's total gates from 146 to 182.
I can see another bond coming to the city.
So here's my question. I never heard what happened after the city of LA leased this land. Who owns it? Because what is the value of
annexed
6,500 acres of oceanfront property in Los Angeles? Yeah. Was that like Rob said? Was that like an eminent domain kind of thing where we annexed it? But who owns this?
Well, I can tell you.
Good question.
The
people of LA, because they paid for it with a bond.
Well, I know for a fact that the remote parking structure that is now concluded and people are now parking there because you need a reservation to park in the U. Now it's all reserved parking because of the construction. There aren't any spots available. So that all that property was achieved by what, like Roger said, eminent domain. That's where the city comes in and says, well, we're buying this property. We're taking it away from you. We're going to give you this much money for it, and you need to move. And most of those were all apartment structures, low rent buildings that were all taken over for years. They remained empty. They tore them all down, and they built this rental car facility, the parking for the airport, and the Uber and Lyft pickup areas. There's no longer curbside. It's in this remote area. So I know all that area was acquired by eminent domain. Who owns the original, 600 and so odd acres?
Yeah, 4,600 or something like that.
That's crazy. I don't know. I can tell you that to this day, when you take off westbound out of LAX, which 99% of the departures are, and you look down, they, a lot of times they tell us, you know, no turns before the shoreline, upon departure, turn left, heading so-and-so, if we're not doing an instrument departure procedure. If you look down, you see there's a blue butterfly preserve. It's about, I don't know, maybe a quarter mile or maybe an eighth of a mile of land between the shore of the Pacific Ocean and the airport perimeter fence. And you can still see all the roads, all the real estate development planned roads that they had built. Those were all going to be houses as an extension of Westchester. Those were all going to be houses. And when the airport said, no, 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 that's going to be part of the airport. You can't have houses there. They were in this huge battle, a legal battle. And then, miraculously, a blue butterfly that is on the endangered species list was found in that area. So they couldn't build. And so the city
was National Park protected area.
Exactly. Yeah. Became a protected area. You can still see the little roads and the cul-de-sacs and all that. The asphalt is still kind of there. And I bet you that was part of the real estate land developer that owned the land back when the airport was first being conceptualized.
Wow.
Now, and a couple more things I wanted to mention. A lot of people say, well, what does the X and LAX stand for? Before the 1930s, U.S. airports used two-letter abbreviations. And at that time, LA served as a designation for Los Angeles Airport. With the rapid growing aviation industry in 1947, the identifiers were then expanded to three letters. And LA received an extra letter to become LAX. The letter X does not otherwise have any specific meaning to its identifier. LAX is also...
I bet it's the 10th airport or something. X, Roman number 10.
Oh, I thought you said you didn't know Roman noodles. Now you know Roman numerals?
That's the only one. It's the Xbox. Yeah.
The 10 box.
Citation 10.
Yeah. X. Yeah, so X does not otherwise have any other specific meaning in the identifier. LAX is also used for the Port of Los Angeles and San Pedro and by Amtrak for Union Station in downtown Los Angeles. So LA, when you say LAX, you could be talking about the airport or some of these other locations as well. Yeah. Also, anyone that's gone in and out of LAX has seen the spaceship. Have you seen the spaceship?
I have no clue what you're talking about.
Oh, well, the spaceship...
You're talking about Jetpack Man?
No. No. The spaceship was actually built in 1961. It is a distinctive theme building designed by Pereira and Lukeman Architects. It was built in 1961 by Robert E. McKee Construction Company, and it resembles a flying saucer that has had landed on its four legs. A restaurant with sweeping views of the airport is suspended beneath two arches that form the legs. The Los Angeles City Council designated the building a Los Angeles Historic Cultural Monument in 1992. A $4 million renovation with retro-futuristic interior and electric lighting designed by Walt Disney Engineering was completed before the Encounter restaurant opened there in 1997, but is no longer in business. Visitors are able to take the elevator up to the observation deck of the theme building, which has previously been closed after the September 11, 2001 attacks for security reasons. A memorial of the 9/11 attacks is located on the grounds, as three of the four hijacked planes were originally destined for Los Angeles. The Bob Hope USO expanded and relocated to the first floor of the theme building in 2018. So, if you've seen the flying saucer, that's what's there now.
I have. I just didn't know that that's what it was. I didn't know that's what it was called.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, I learned a little bit. Here I have been flying in and out of Los Angeles for close to two decades, and I didn't know some of this stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. I like those. You learn about some of the airports you fly into and why they're named that way. Yeah, it's cool.
I always get a kick out of seeing old movies that are on location. And in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. that's not hard to do. But LAX in particular has had a lot of film and television shows filmed there. Usually it's because of its proximity to Hollywood and its studios, but also, I mean, it's a historic place, Los Angeles.
Yeah.
The opening credit scene to 1967's The Graduate, starring Dustin Hoffman, is filmed passing wearily through the LAX concourse. The LA International Airport has been inspiration for a lot of music out there. In 1976, Walt Disney comedy film No Deposit, No Return has scenes throughout the Los Angeles International Airport. The 1984 movie Starman has a scene where Japan Airlines Boeing 747 is taking off from Los Angeles. We've seen stock footage, of course, of airplanes taking off and landing. 1985 film To Live and Die in L.A. featuring stunt at the L.A. terminal. Pretty cool. The Chipmunk adventure film. And these are just films from the 1960s to the 1990s. And I can go on and on. Everything from The Net, Liar Liar, Face Off, Turbulence starring Ray Liotta and Lauren Holly. I mean, there's so many. I can go on and on and on. So, yeah. Cool. Next time you're watching a film, keep an eye out. It could be filmed at an airport near you. Well, gentlemen, it's been a real interesting show. A pleasure to sit down and chat with all of you. I want to say thank you to Alex for allowing us to record him.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, can you imagine? Yeah, on my first flight of IOE, and first time in a jet, and I just wanted to call into my buddies over at the podcast and tell them what's going on.
Yeah.
And I'm really nervous.
Is that okay?
I'm really nervous, Sam, but I don't know how my passengers feel. How are you feeling back there?
Yeah, and we're sitting in the terminal, and the flight's late, and hi, guys, it's my first flight. Hi.
I remember there was a flirty captain that was greeting some passengers as they boarded, and this very, very attractive young adult with their newborn baby was boarding, and the captain goes, "Oh, what a cute baby. Is this his first flight?" And she's like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Well, then we have something in common."
What?
So the lady's like, "Yeah, well, I hope it's not the first flight. And you're really cute, because that would freak me out." Oh, man. Oh. That was great.
Yeah, I love pilots that are able to, yeah, like have a little bit of fun with themselves in that situation. Yeah. It's a fun job. Don't be so serious. Why so serious?
I don't know if HR so much like that.
Yeah, nowadays, someone's good. Got that on Twitter.
Yeah,
posted
you gotta
it.
Be careful. Uh-huh. You gotta be very careful.
Well, we've all seen that gif of the captain who's sitting there in the first class galley, and he's got that book on, says, "How to Fly Airplanes." He's in there reading the book, "How to Fly Airplanes." Someone took his picture.
Yep.
Well, we've graduated from past that. Now we just watch YouTube.
Yeah, now we just hold your phone.
In video.
Don't talk to me. I'm watching
a
video.
Hey, man, I said it many times. I'm on the podcast. I use YouTube for many lessons. So
yeah,
like how to fly airplanes.
Yeah.
It helps. It works.
Yeah. Yeah. Right now, how to start up a Boeing 737. I mean, it's all on there.
That's it, man.
Well, gentlemen, I just want to say thank you. Thank you to Captain Roger, to Rob D, and to Alex D for joining us today. Did you enjoy listening to our episode today? I hope so. If you could, please pay it forward and tell a friend, post it, let everyone know. Squawk Ident is here, 114 episodes in. We're real proud of it, and we hope you are too. Make sure you subscribe and follow to the Squawk Ident podcast on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. We also love receiving listener feedback, so don't hesitate and send us an email or a quick voice message. You can do that right there on your phone. Just record a quick audio file on your phone. Say, "Hey, Aviator Tony, whatever, you're full of it, whatever," and just send it our way. You can email it to us right there from our website. There's a link to just contact us. You can also use the audio recording software that's on the website. You can send us a, I think it's a 90-second audio from there. The iPhone recordings usually work better. You can ramble on for a lot longer. Check us out on the website, www.aviatortony.com. That's Alpha, Victor, the number 8, Romeo, Tango, Oscar, November, Yankee.com. You can also help produce this show and send us whatever you can. A couple bucks here and there really helps keep this podcast going. Websites and, you know, subscriptions, they're not cheap. So anything you can do does help us out. You can also check us out on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. No, I'm not really on the Twitter much anymore. I'm trying to stay away. I know a lot of podcasts are going to TikTok and Snapchat and all that stuff. And, you know, I looked around and I don't know, maybe it's a generational thing. I just deleted it.
It's hard to get going if you're not into it.
We're not on the TikTok, folks.
We're not on the TikToks. No, I know Captain Roger Victor, a former guest of this episode, is now on TikTok almost exclusively. He's no longer on Facebook. So if you want to see the puppet, Captain, that's Captain Roger Victor.
Yep.
You'll have to be on the TikToks. And that I did enjoy watching some of his TikToks. Still do. Yeah. But anyway, folks, we really love doing this program. We hope you enjoy listening. One final thank you to all of you for taking the time to listen to these grateful aviators. Keep the dirty side down out there. Be safe and take care of each other. Bye, y'all.
See ya.
Bye now.
Ciao. Hey, where's my sandwich? I'm hungry.
Ma!
Ma!
Meatloaf!
Meatloaf, Ma!
Ma!
What's she... never know what she's doing. God. What
just doing don't touch my drum set. Don't touch my drum set.
You want some? You whiff?
Okay. Okay.
I think you've watched that one too many times there, Rob.
Funerals.
That's damn you, sad. Roger! Damn you!
So...
I gotta watch that.
Damn you, Roger!
Step Brothers.
My boy Blue!
Ma! All right, gentlemen, let me hit this button.
All right.
Recording stopped.
Hit this button right here. Give me 10 seconds.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.